No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRadioPR. We have a very special guest tonight, and first let me introduce Maria, and then we'll get right to the show. Maria, how are you?
I'm excellent, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm good. And I'm so excited
to
have our guest tonight. We have with us tonight the former lieutenant governor of Maryland, a state in which I grew up, chairman of the Republican Party. In fact, he was the first African-American chairperson of the Republican National Committee. And he was charged with revitalizing the Republican Party. He has his own radio show on SiriusXM with it's the Steele and Unger show. He was the lieutenant governor of Maryland. And I read this. He may have to correct me on this because I couldn't believe it. I read that he was the first statewide African-American elected in Maryland, which I find that so hard to believe.
I read that, too.
Yeah, in a state that's 300 years old, getting close to 300 years old, 250 years old. And as as lieutenant governor, he was charged with improving the quality of Maryland's public education system, expanding economic development in the state, reforming the state's minority business enterprise program, and fostering cooperation between government and faith-based organizations to help those in need. That's exactly the kind of thing we want to talk about tonight. He's also a part of the new Institute for Politics, Policy, and History. You may remember we had the Mayor Pratt on a few weeks ago to talk about that, so maybe we can talk about that for a moment. But welcome to the show, Lieutenant Governor, and thanks so much for being on.
It's good to be with you both. Absolutely. Thank you.
And let me just add before we go any further that in 2000, this is one of the reasons we love this man, that in 2007, he wrote an op-ed with Congressman J.C. Watts in the Washington Times calling on fellow Republicans to support the bill for D.C. statehood. He tied this to the civil rights movement. So thank you so much for your support, Lieutenant Governor. It's great to have you on the show.
That's easy. As a native Washingtonian, that's an easy one. That's a gimme. So it was a real honor to do that. And, you know, it's an ongoing struggle. I think most people have kind of realized by now that that question is one that seems to get blocked by both Democrats and Republicans. So whether it's a Republican administration with a majority Republican Congress or a Democratic one, the question still remains an open one. So still a lot more work out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And we appreciate your support. And, you know, I went just the opposite. I moved to Maryland when I was 12 years old and lived there until I graduated from graduate school at the University of Maryland. And then I moved into the district. And I know that you went to school here in Washington, D.C. So, and we're proud to claim you as a Washingtonian. I've got to tell you.
Absolutely.
And you know, we're in a struggle right now with you guys because we're fighting over Frederick Douglass. You know, I know it's his birthday, and he was a slave in Maryland, I believe. But you
he was
know,
born in, he was born in Maryland. Yeah, he's a Marylander. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know,
we're happy to lend the name, but that's about it.
Yeah.
What are you fighting over, Michael?
Well,
who can
it's
from? Fight?
It's his. I believe it's his 250th birthday. I could be wrong, or his 200th birthday. But anyway, there's celebrations going on, and Washington wants to claim him because he had several official roles. He was an elected official and had a business here in Washington, and of course, he was Abraham Lincoln's guy. But he was born in Maryland, and he was a slave in Maryland. So we're both kind of claiming him these days.
There you go.
It doesn't sound fair to me.
But he was a great enough man. He was a great enough man that there's enough of him to go around, fortunately.
Well, that's true,
right,
too.
All right. You go for you have the honor of asking the first question there, Maria, because you're my Republican co-host.
Thank you. And it is an honor, and it's just a real privilege to have you on the program with us. And what we said at the beginning of the show, is that true? Are you the first African-American elected?
I am.
Wow.
First elected statewide African-American official. But, you know, I like to think I started something because we've had two black lieutenant governors since I've was elected, one currently serving. So we seem to have opened a door, which is a good door to open.
And do you have any aspirations for other offices, elected offices?
Yeah, you know, we'll take a look at, you know, what's ahead after Larry Hogan. There's a Senate race coming up as well. So, you know, there's still some options. As I like to tell people, I've got at least one more race left in me. So we'll see how that goes over the next couple of years.
Good for you. Because you're still so young.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Well, it's true.
although my body reminds me every morning when I get out of bed with a new pain. I was like, okay, I didn't feel that before I went to bed last night, but okay, let's roll with it.
Well, you know, you're so kind to come on the show, so I don't want to depress you, but just wait. I'm kidding.
Right.
Every day that I get up, I go, what? Yesterday I did this. What happened today? So it doesn't get a whole lot better. But let me ask you, since you mentioned the governor's name, there's an article in the Post today saying that he may be considering running for president of the United States, and that even if he's not considering, I think he said he hasn't ruled it out, but he really hasn't considered it. There are other people that are pushing him in that direction. What do you think about him?
Well,
as a
I think he's got time. He's got time. There's a lot of noise. This is not. It would not be an easy journey, regardless. Even if the president somehow tripped up and had some issues, whether it's out of the Mueller probe or something else, the fact of the matter is the party is squarely behind the president as of right now. In the RNC, especially. I mean, the governor was criticizing the RNC for its efforts to protect the president's electoral interest over the next cycle. But that's somewhat to be expected, although I agree with the governor. Once the president has declared himself to be a candidate, he's no different than any other candidate seeking the office, even though he's the incumbent. The party has to make itself available to everyone who wants to run, and certainly former Governor Weld of Massachusetts has already announced he's in the Republican primary. So there will be a challenge to Trump in the upcoming cycle. What degree of success they have, to what degree do more people get in, that remains to be seen. I think Governor Hogan still has plenty of runway to decide whether or not he wants to actually do this, even though a lot of people are excited about the prospects of his running and certainly excited about what his brand of Republicanism can mean for a party that has been Trumpified over the last 2 years. But that all has to play itself out. And as we all know, money, timing, momentum, support, all of that is going to be a factor ultimately in whether or not there's any modicum of success in the run.
Well, you know, the one thing that surprised me, in the article was the comments he made about the RNC, because my first job, one of my first political jobs, was at the DNC, working on Carter's reelection, and that
right.
that was really our mandate. They, you know, I mean, one of the first things I did was I worked on a project to see how far we could keep Kennedy delegates away from the microphones on the floor of the convention, because Kennedy was a challenger in 1980, briefly a challenger. So we really saw that as, you know, that was our job to make sure that that nobody interfered with Carter's reelection. Of course, we didn't do a very good job at it, but you know, so that surprised me a little. But I think he's one of the most amazing Maryland governors I've seen in a long time. I mean, governors anywhere.
Yeah, no, he's done a job. I mean, he's one of the, you know, he and Charlie Baker of Massachusetts go back and forth as to who's the most popular governor at any given poll in any given week. But he's done a good job. He's been able to lay down a lot of positive, you know, policies and taken, you know, positions that a lot of Marylanders support. So he's well positioned. Now, again, that's being the governor of Maryland. Not the same as being the governor of Florida or the governor of California or some other states that, you know, Ohio, certainly one of the battleground states. But he's very well regarded, very popular. He will take over, I believe, the head of the RGA, the Republican Governors Association, sometime in July. So he'll have a national perch from which to really position his kind of Republicanism, and that may lead to his decision to enter the race come the fall, but we'll see.
Well, you know, and the first guy I ever worked for in politics really was the governor of Maryland. His name was Spiro Agnew, and I was 12 years old, and I just moved to Maryland.
Right.
And my mom took me across the street on election day to meet the kid across the street, and his mom was a Republican precinct chairman. She slapped a skimmer on both our heads and took us out to the polls, and we handed out literature for Spiro Agnew. So we've seen other Maryland governors, but you're right. Maryland's not California, and it's certainly not Ohio or New York or any one of those states.
Exactly.
So, Maria, I don't want to monopolize the time here.
Because I wanted to ask you, Lieutenant Governor, was your journey with the party, the Republican Party, one that you expected? Or I identify as Hispanic, and I'm in this blue state of California.
Right.
And sometimes I feel like the right wing of the party, especially the Christian wing, tends to identify with who we are rather than the party that I see the Republican Party to be. And I'm curious what your feelings are about that.
Well, the party's journey has certainly evolved and taken a few twists and turns since the days of Reagan. In fact, my analysis is that the party has been dealing with a self-imposed or self-created identity crisis since Reagan left office. You know, it starts with, okay, who will be the next Reagan? And so you have a number of leaders who've emerged to try to be that Reagan figure, whether it's a Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or some other, you know, senator or governor or candidate. And that often leads to internecine discussions and battles over what that means and what that looks like. And I think what we saw was among the rank and file voters, a lot of dissatisfaction and disgust even with the way the party was trending, making a lot of promises it wasn't keeping, promoting things that were antithetical to the core of who the party at least espoused itself to be, and made that journey much more difficult for rank and file Republicans, to the point that you saw in 2006 a wholesale rejection of Republican candidates across the country. I know that well because I was one of those candidates running for the U.S. Senate, and it didn't matter what people thought of my service as lieutenant governor or how much they liked me. I was Republican. That was enough to vote no. and you see that storyline playing itself out still in the 2018 election cycle with Donald Trump. What has happened though since 2006 and 2015? 2016 was Trump entered the discussion, and in my analysis, in effect, sort of stopped the conversation. So the party really hasn't battled out that sort of identity crisis, which is why it is, I think, so easily Trumpified, because you know it is sort of wavered off of the sort of Reagan image and ideal, and that's understandable over time. Particularly if there are no voices that really have kind of carried that mantle or can be identified as the next Reagan. So you have this space in, you know, politics affords a vacuum. Someone or something fills it. And Donald Trump, in many respects, had done that. And he was able to do it by making the promise and then keeping the promise. And I think that that's why you see him sitting there now with such a strong, anchored base of Republicans that, quite frankly, it's just struck fear in a lot of Republicans, elected officials around the country, because that base is so tethered to Trump that you dare not challenge it. You dare not certainly challenge Trump without, you know, getting the having the wrath of that base, you know, reap itself upon your head. So it's a very interesting dynamic right now in the party. The reality, I think a lot of us are kind of coming to grips with is when this moment passes, when Trumpism is over, what happens? So either Trumpism dies or it becomes the Republican Party. And you'll have more candidates and activists sort of taking up that sort of aspect of Trumpism and pushing it forward. Very much as we saw with Reagan and his policies after Reagan stepped off the stage, and that, you know, lasted well up to the 1990s, and then by the time you got to the 2000 election with George Bush, it sort of dissipated, and so we'll see. I mean, this could be the beginning of a period of the party that is going to be. One that can be identified as classic Trump, or it's going to be a one-off, in which case it reverts into something closer to what it was before. And I think that's the battle that a lot of people are trying to gear itself up for, because we don't know how that looks.
And so, what do you think, I'm sorry, just as a follow-up, what do you think about that in terms of your Republican Party and my Republican Party versus a Trumpism Republican Party?
Well, I identify as a Lincoln Republican, so I'm old school. I go back to the founding ideals of the party. The party was born out of this struggle over slavery and abolitionism, which was to abolish the shackles that tied men's souls, if you will, that tied them down, that bound them. The party spoke and fought about individual rights and liberties. It, you know, it championed the civil rights legislation, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, the Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights, the Voting Rights Act. It championed affirmative action, promoting the first affirmative action in the country's history, which was 40 acres and a mule. And, of course, modern-day affirmative action under Richard Nixon in the 1960s, 68-72, in that period. So there, you know, and that was became manifest by the Jack Kemp sort of wing of the party, sort of economic empowerment, sort of recognizing that all of this is tied together, but at the end, a family, an individual needs to be financially secure and find their way up the ladder. So you had these ideas and these principles that really mattered in the formation of the party in its early days and certainly sustaining the party subsequent to that. And then overarching all of that policy was the Reagan-esque view of a shining city on a hill, looking at America, looking at communities as bright lights, manifest also by George Bush, who talked about 1,000 points of lights, recognizing individuals making a difference on behalf of a greater good. We've walked away from a lot of those, certainly the rhetoric and certainly the ideals as well. And so my hope is that, you know, we're going to have a fight. I want to have a fight over that. I want to put the test to the party and to individuals in the party to say, is this who we are, or are we a party that's more consumed about just winning and more consumed about self-preservation and self-interest that we're willing to take on and tear down institutions like, you know, legal institutions, criminal justice institutions, economic institutions, relationships with our foreign, you know, with our international friends, cozying up to our adversaries. Is that who we are? And so I want to have that discussion. And I think it's an important one to have, because I think it not only will speak to the direction of the country, I mean, of the party, but it will speak to the direction of the country as well, and the ability of the party to actually have voters, again, support our candidates if that's what we're pushing. So, you know, building walls and isolating communities and you know, personalizing politics in a way that dehumanizes as opposed to lifts them up. So that for me is really the front line of this upcoming struggle that we were about to engage in, by the way, until Donald Trump sort of came in and interrupted that conversation.
Well, you know, first of all, let me tell you, Lieutenant Governor, that much of what you just said, I just came from 3 days of DNC meetings, and the DNC finds itself in a similar position. The Democrats sure. find themselves in a similar position. And one thing that's always bothered me, you say you're a Lincoln Republican. I'm a good Christian, and it always bothered me when I was working for Carter, who was also a good Christian, that somehow the Democratic Party lost Christianity. I don't know how that happened. And the Republican Party lost civil rights. You know, all the things you said about the civil rights movement sure. are true. And in fact, when I go out and I talk to people, especially young people, and I mention that Martin Luther King was a Republican, I can't tell you, they always correct me. They go, oh, no, he was a Democrat. And I go, no, he was a Republican. Many African Americans in the South
yeah,
were Republicans because
exactly.
it was Democrats who stood in the way of desegregation. It wasn't
right.
Republicans. It was Democrats
right.
in the South, right? The Republicans couldn't even be Republicans at one point. They became the Dixiecrats because they couldn't get elected as Republicans. So how does your party get back to being the civil, a party of the civil rights?
I think that's a harder question to answer, because it requires the kind of soul searching that has a lot of pain attached to it and a lot of truth attached to it. And I think, you know, when you have the head of your party, and the president's the titular head of the party, declare himself to be a nationalist, that's not something I want to go into a black community or Hispanic community mm-hmm. or gay community or stand in front of a group of women and tout, because we all know what it means. I mean, you can't dress up nationalism. You know, this kind of populism has never been healthy. History shows us that. It has proven that. It is never healthy. You know, the rhetoric is great, and people feel like, oh, okay, I've got these guys who are going to go out and they're going to fight for us, and they're going to, you know, make my life better. Well, the nature of America and its history has always been, we never rely on someone else to make our lives better. We rely on ourselves. We rely on our own ingenuity. We rely on our God-given gifts and talents to do that. And we band together as a community so that everyone benefits from that. But we never look at a government or an institution, or certainly not one individual, to make our lives better. That's what set us apart from the rest of the world nations historically. So, and it's why people still want to come here from those places where you have leaders who talk like that, you know?
Right.
And so I think for the party, it puts itself in a little bit of a big hole. The deeper and the more it aligns itself with this sort of national populism that is not born out of the ideals and principles of, you know, 1854 when we were founded, and certainly not after the ideals and principles that formed and forged the party after the Civil War, but rather that are born and forged out of fear and anger and distrust. and quite honestly, disliking those who aren't like you. You're not from my tribe, therefore there's something wrong or bad about you. And I just don't think that, that's a winning message to take to communities in the future. And we will see as the country continues to brown, as Hispanics and African Americans, particularly Hispanic numbers, continue to grow. And, you know, everyone's going, oh, well, their numbers are, you know, are growing, but they're not voting. Well, guess what, my friend? After this period, I think that's going to change.
Yeah.
I think Hispanics have been awakened to the fact, oh, you know what? It's not enough just to be in America. We need to be a part of America. And that means being full citizens and taking advantage of the rights and privileges that come under the Constitution, starting with the vote. And you're going to see that. We've already begun to see it. So does the party want to be outside of that when it occurs? I hope it doesn't. I don't think it does. But it likely will be if it continues on the road that it's currently on.
Well, is there room for moderates today, like Kasich of Ohio, who sounds like, I got to tell you, the governor of Ohio, when I listen to him, sounds like one of the few grown-ups out there on either side these days. And so is there room for him in your party?
It's hard. I mean, the space is narrowed tremendously. And it's the same issue that Hogan is going to run into if he decides to jump into the race. That Kasich is having to deal with, and the same is true on the left. The progressive wing of the party,
right,
championed by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, now Ocasio-Cortez, are the two sides of the same coin. You know, on one side you've got progressive, on the other side you have disaffected Tea Party, which is now Trumpism, and so it's there is no space for those who have. You can be center-right. You can actually be, you know, a hard-charging liberal or a hard-charging conservative. But it, in all of that, you've got to recognize that not everyone is in the same space with you, and that if you want to get something done, you're going to have to welcome a different approach, a different opinion, a different way of doing things, and you're going to have to do that dirty thing that a lot of people in this town seemingly don't want to do, and that is to build a consensus around ideas so that you can reach a compromise and move forward on actually getting policy done. That's going to be the big test and the big battle. And the next Democratic nominee and Republican candidates who may challenge Trump are going to have to find a way to make that case to an electorate which is more and more suspicious because what they see up to now has not worked. And for those who follow Trump, what he's doing, look, we got the judges, we got this, we're doing that, okay. And for progressives, it's the idea of, you know, stripping all of that away. But you can't do that without those, you know, folks from the middle of the country.
Right.
Well, and that's to my point, because Michael and I agree probably 85% of the time on issues, but that's because I am ridiculously socially liberal, but I am fiscally conservative, and I'm all about less government and, you know, less taxation and giving people the opportunity to find fish instead of giving them the fish, as you were talking about earlier, about we're responsible for our success, and the empowerment that we have entitles us to do that. So I don't know if when you talk about space in the room, is it possible for a Republican to be liberal socially and not have to be right wing the whole way?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Look, you know, you always talk about the Northeastern Republican, for example, you know, the Rockefeller type Republican that generally is, you know, socially moderate to liberal, certainly fiscally conservative. But let's step back from that. Before you even get into that, you have to understand where the Republican Party was before 1980. Before 1980, the Republican Party, by and large, did not wrap up social issues into a lot of its public policies. It wasn't something that you saw touted in its platform. It was something that very, very few elected officials pushed. Why? Because at the core of Republicanism is a form of libertarianism. where we were very much, it was, you know, the government, keep the government out of these things. The government has no business in making decisions on behalf of individuals and families that affect their lives. Those decisions, those choices, to use that very hot word, should be left up to the individuals. That's something that the party in large measure supported and adhered to. So you never saw the push on a lot of these big social issues. Along comes Roe versus Wade, the 1960s, the sexual revolution, the upheaval, certainly in the southern states where Democrats were making that pivot towards civil rights and ticking off a lot of folks who weren't buying that. Republicans were making that pivot away from civil rights, but now trying to figure out how to win, presidential elections if you're going to lose some of these folks. And what happens by the time you get to 1980, a bargain is struck with this emerging political, quasi-political group of activists known as the Moral Majority. And for the first time in 1980 at the National Convention, Ronald Reagan capitulated and allowed a plank to be put into the platform that talked about pro-life, on the heels of Roe versus Wade. And so that was the introduction. And, you know, that would then go on and course through the veins of the party and culminate in some battles that started to emerge that manifest. You remember the Terri Schiavo case Florida, the young mother who was comatose for 14 or so years, and her husband, wanted to take her off life support and end her life, and her parents didn't. And it got into this back and forth in the courts and certainly became a political ping pong ball. And the Senate emerged and got involved in it. Jeb Bush, the then governor of Florida, took the side of the woman's family. The president called the Congress back to Washington to put out a resolution supporting keeping this woman alive. And that really ticked off that what was left of that libertarian wing in the party that recognized the individual rights and freedoms to make those decisions free of government interference. So the party, has always recognized that you can be, socially liberal, socially conservative. That's not my concern. What we want when it comes to government action, we want to make sure that we keep government from overtaxing you, overburdening your businesses, overregulating how you educate your children, overregulating other aspects of your life, and allowing you to make the decisions within your own given community on all these other big matters. And that was pretty much where Republicans stood for generations until that fateful decision in 1980 to sort of mix in the sort of religious political piece on abortion, which we've now been living with since that time.
Let me ask you, are there Lowell Weickers, Bob Packwoods, Barry Goldwaters, are there people in the Republican Party that can move the party in a different direction?
Sure, but they have to be willing to move themselves. I mean, in other words, there are people there who can emerge, and we can look for leaders to do that. But as we've already seen, if you're sitting around and waiting for someone to take on Trump, they typically don't want to do that until they're leaving office, Flake and others. So I think that this is going to have to come from within the party itself. My expectation is not, to have one senator or congressman or governor do that. I think it's going to be the galvanizing of activists and others who say, this is who we are, which I hate to say leads me to believe that the party will likely fracture in some respects after this period, because I don't see how you reconcile that. And particularly if there's anything that forces Trump out of office or, you know, makes this a, you know, an ugly mess at the end of his first term, or if he gets unelected by the voters, there's going to be recrimination. And I think we need to be prepared for that and recognize just how difficult it will be to heal the party after something like that, because a lot of these folks are already touting on Twitter and other social media outlets, you know, let's save our president, let's protect our president, as if he's somehow being attacked by, you know, some foreign entity or something. But when you have that mindset, when you've got reputable Republicans going out saying that we are in a civil war already on, you know, social issues and issues of race and things like that, you kind of ask yourself, and these are supposedly level-headed Republicans making these outrageously stupid claims, then you have to ask yourself, where do you go when their response is to that grassroots activist base? You need to do two things: vote and arm yourself. Really? That's my solution? To arm myself? And who declared a civil war, and who are we fighting, and what are we fighting about? So this is where the hot passions and rhetoric of this period, to me, I think instigated largely by this president, who quite frankly is agnostic to all of this. For him, this is all reality TV. This is all part of the shtick. Because, you know, the man does not have a core that drives him. Because if he did, he would not have given the response he gave to Charlottesville. He would not have given the response to the young children being caged by our border security agents. He would not have given the response he just gave a few days ago
about the Coast Guard officer
to the Coast Guard, which he still hasn't given a response to.
Right.
Well, let me ask you. Is this fracturing? I hate to use the T word because I know that both Republicans and Democrats hate this word, but will this fracturing, do you think it leads to the rise of a third party? Do we get a third party some way out of this?
There's seeds there. It's going to take time. I don't think a third party will emerge at the national level per se. I think the strength of something like that really will germinate at the grassroots level, where you have, you know, an independent candidate for governor, an independent candidate for city council or mayor or something like that. People have to get used to voting for someone outside of the political boxes in big numbers. And they'll do it. You know, Ross Perot got, 5%, 7% of the vote when he ran for president or something like that. We've seen, you know, states do it. You know, Jesse Ventura in Minnesota got elected governor. But then they quickly moved off of that because that turned into, you know, sort of a crazy nightmare. So it's something that the country has kind of played with and toyed around. And certainly you've got, you know, some potential with a Mike Bloomberg, for example, although I think he probably would more likely run as a Democrat this time around than as an independent. But he's independent-minded. And even Bernie Sanders, who, you know, is a democratic socialist, whatever the hell that is. But he aligns himself with the Democratic Party, runs it in its primary. Right. That kind of action, while confusing, does act as a germinating seed for potential third-party, situation in the future, which I welcome. I think the country is matured enough now to branch beyond the two parties. But let's be honest, as you know, Senator, and I know, as you know, folks who are in elected or quasi-elected roles, that the parties, the political systems, don't want that. They do not want it. A third party parade to start. Both parties have systems designed to prevent that, whether it's the hurdles you have to overcome to get registered in any given state, the money you've got to raise to do that, the votes you've got to get petition-wise, to put your name on a ballot. It is crazy. It is definitely something that is akin to a wall, if you will. But that doesn't mean that the voters at some point will overcome all of that and really begin to break some ground in that direction, which I think could happen sooner rather than later.
Well, yeah, so I can tell you just about that. Sorry, Michael. In California, my Republican friends have chosen to register decline to state.
Right.
I don't know if that's throughout the country, but they say they don't recognize the party anymore, but they're not Democrats. So they just rather
and that represent that decline to state, independent voters. And every state has a different name for that person who's not a Republican or a Democrat. That represents about 40% nationally now of the identity. So you've got 40% of people will identify themselves on a national level as independent. Just use that term, generic term. And the Republican and Democratic parties, you know, fight over the remaining 60%. So, you know, it could be 37, you know, percent to, you know, 22% or whatever, 23%, or, you know, it just depends. And so it's there. And states are seeing more and more of it. In Maryland, the largest block of voters, certainly in my home county, is independent. And even though we're outnumbered 2-1 by Democrats, tells you just how many Republicans we have in my county here. You're seeing the trend line there. People are saying, you know what, a pox on both their houses. I'm just going to settle over here and make them work harder for my vote. And I think you're going to see that in this upcoming cycle where Democratic candidates, and this is the challenge they're going to have, you know, they're being pushed to a far extreme on some of these issues, in my estimation. It's not where I think the country is. The country is not about, you know, here, free for everything, free for all, because everybody who has to sit at a kitchen table and balance a checkbook, pay taxes, et cetera, knows that somebody has to pay for free.
Right.
And you need to clearly define for me who pays for free. And I'm not in a position to pay for it any longer. And that was witnessed by the response, the backlash to the tax cuts, which everyone now, Republicans begrudgingly, but everyone acknowledge that that tax cut that we saw has benefited the top 1%, 2%, 3% of the country, not the middle of the country. So they're fed up and tired, and the idea that you're now going to come back around and start saying, well, we're going to give you free education, we want to give you free health care, we want to give you this, and we got to deal with the environment, all this, and, you know, while people like the sound of that, their reality doesn't allow them to actually buy into it. So, and we saw that in Florida. I think the turning point in Florida, folks, was the realization that, wait a minute, I like Gillum and I understand what he's saying and I got the whole race piece and, you know, we got to get past that. But if he's governor and he does what he says he's going to do, who's going to pay for all of that? I actually had a voter tell me that, and that hit them over the, you know, the last week of the campaign. Because remember, the first part of that campaign was all caught up in the racial stuff, you know, mm-hmm. the monkeying up, by the Republican candidate. And I think a lot of folks sort of said once they got past that point and started looking at where these gentlemen were, just didn't buy the idea that Florida state without an income tax is somehow going to pay for all of this.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you, the most distressing things about what you just said to me as a Democrat is that, again, with 3 days with the Democratic Party, they weren't talking about any of this. They were talking about redistricting and coming up with a better strategy and getting people out there to the, you know, to get out the vote. Not that those things are not important, but they weren't talking about this whole realignment. And that really worries me they don't have a grasp on the issues yet.
Well, and that's because the issues haven't really been defined by the Democrats so much. Although I have to give them props on, and this is something I think a lot of people have not paid attention to, and you can go back, so don't take my word for it, just go back and look at the numbers. A lot of people think because of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, congresswoman from New York, from, you know, congresswoman, X, Y, and Z, or this person from, you know, this liberal, or progressive wing, that all these progressives got elected in November of 2018. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, the vast majority of the Democrats elected to the Congress, the vast majority of those women elected to the Congress, were moderates. They weren't liberals. They weren't progressives. They were moderates. And whether they were from New Jersey or whether they were from Kansas or whether they were from Nevada, wherever they happened to be from, they reflected a more moderate, temperate Democratic perspective on a lot of these issues. They weren't selling, universal health care and all of that. They were talking to the point that you just made, Senator, about grassroots stuff. Yeah. You know, the congresswoman who was elected, she was a congresswoman, state legislative candidate who beat a hard conservative in a very red legislative district in Virginia. You know how she won? The Democrat, and she was a transgendered individual on top of that.
Right.
In this very red district, she won talking about traffic lights. She won talking about traffic. And the people, you know, voted for someone who's going to address the core issue that that community faced. And while her Republican opponent was running around, you know, castigating her for being transgendered and running against her sexual orientation, she was running about putting up, fixing the roads, putting up traffic lights, picking up the trash.
I hate to interrupt you, but I've got to tell you, because I've been meaning to tell you this the whole show. The one thing that really impressed me right off the bat about Governor Hogan was he reduced the toll on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. He came out and he said, the bridge has been paid for. You know, I consider that one of the most brilliant political moves that I've seen in years, because people, I mean, you're so right about that. People care about these things, and that's something that annoys people.
That's the kind of grassroots connection that, you know, elected officials have to make. You know, get off of these big national storylines. Who cares? That's not what I'm worried about sitting at my kitchen table. I'm worried about the fact that I've got, you know, a child with a disability or, a parent who needs, you know, senior care, or I'm trying to figure out, you know, how I can afford to get to work because of the time it takes to commute, the cost of that commute, et cetera. Dealing with those issues is critically important. And so when the governor comes out and he says, look, you know, we have families and business owners who cross the Key Bridge, every day, and they can't afford it. So let's cut it back. Similarly, when he got into it with the teachers union about when the school year would start, and he was like, no, we're going to start the school year after Labor Day. Why? Because that works best for families. Now they have an extra 2 weeks at the end of summer, you know. The fact that parents were, you know, have to cut vacation short, or, you know, that window between when school, and particularly if they drag the school year out because of snow days to the middle or the end of June, you're really only talking the month of July, because the second week of August, you're back in school. And so the governor was like, we'll give the parents extra 2 weeks. And that was like a 70% issue.
That's our Achilles heel in the Democratic Party, is we're always talking down to America, right? We're always saying, you don't know that you need more school, but let me tell you why you do, you know, rather than listening to the feedback.
Parents will tell you what they need. They will tell you what they need. Elected officials then just have to figure out how to deliver what they need. And that's a big part of leadership. But my overarching argument on that front is that leaders have forgotten how to listen. They don't listen any longer to their constituents. They listen to special interests. They listen to those very, very narrow, loud, screaming voices. that are clanging the biggest and the loudest drum. And meanwhile, those everyday issues of substance don't get addressed. The frustration grows. And at some point, it explodes. And we've seen many explosions over the last few years.
I think we have a caller. Is Taboo still on the line? Is he calling in?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh, I'm sorry, Taboo. It's hard to interrupt Lieutenant Governor Steele because he's such an amazing guest. But go ahead. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, and I agree with you. It's really hard to interrupt, but thank you for doing so. First, Mr. Steele, am I correct in hearing you say that you are a Lincoln Republican?
Yes.
Okay, Lincoln wanted to deport American blacks, send us to South America. You know, he said he was the one who said that whites should be superior to the blacks. And you're against the wall, am I correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, then you're not in line with the average American person, American black. See, this is why you have
American
Trump
black
who's bringing
the wall.
Yeah, I disagree with
majority?
You there, Taboo. I don't know where you get your information, but
well, if you let me speak, because I am one of those little people that you're talking about, who we've been concerned about all the time. As you said earlier, we used to work for ourselves. We used to work together. And you see, but if you look at Mr. Steele, you know. Well, let me ask you a question, Mr. Steele, rather than talk. What is the status, or what would you say the condition of the majority of American blacks in this country? Would you say it's financially good, or how would you classify it?
It's financially questionable. I mean, there are pockets of success and wealth that have been created. I mean, if you look at the Oscars tonight, you will see some examples of that. If you look at our sports industry, you look at entertainment for sure. Even if you look at the scientific community and academic community, you look across the spectrum, you can always identify black success. It has not been evenly achieved, for sure. A lot of the urban blight centers largely around communities of color.
Which
has not been addressed. And that's the
okay, quick, Taboo. We're almost out of time here.
That's the one last question. Who typically don't address those issues as elected officials.
Has illegal immigration hurt working class people, black and white?
No. Illegal immigration? Yeah.
Illegal immigration, yes.
I think illegal immigration has had an impact, for sure. There's no doubt about it. But let's be honest. We all know, if we're honest, that there are jobs that certain jobs that blacks don't want to take any longer. In the
name it,
industry.
Name it. Stop the lie. No. Name it. It's the pay issue, Mr. Steele. Don't do that. Black people have worked any job that was. It was the pay. And when you have illegal immigration, it's about supply and demand of labor.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for your input, Taboo.
No, I appreciate his input, but I mean, you know, the problem with the discussion like this is that if you come to the table, you're not really listening to look at it 360, then it becomes harder to have the discussion. You know, he started off talking about, well, Lincoln was against this. Well, Lincoln, by the end of, you know, his life, you know, Lincoln, where he started is not where Lincoln ended up.
Correct.
And Lincoln was very clear about his own evolution as he got to talk and spend time with guys like Frederick Douglass. That isolation is what allowed Lincoln to sort of hold a view about the black man that he later discarded, and became the champion of African-American freedom, the Emancipation Proclamation, for example, and started to lay down how blacks would be assimilated after the war. Unfortunately, we don't get to hear the rest of that story because he was assassinated. So, I mean, you just can't cherry pick your facts and say, well, this fact speaks about the rest of history. That's a fact in time, and I think it's important that we all be very clear about, you know, the totality of history, not just that one particular aspect. Yeah, I know how Lincoln started up, but I also know how he ended up, and I think that that's what matters more than anything else.
Agreed.
Well, and I agree with you. And I think this is a big problem that we have today. And Marie and I have talked about it many times, that we label people and then we think we know everything about them. You know,
and if I could just say one thing real quick, folks, I'm not going to buy into this sort of manufactured rivalry or even war between blacks and Hispanics. You know, pitting, you know, black people against, you know, immigrants to this country. I'm just not going to buy that. Illegal immigration impacts everybody, which is why we have to be honest in addressing it. There's no doubt about that. But I'm not going to sit here and pretend that, you know, if a Hispanic individual gets a job, that somehow that cuts a chance for an African-American individual to get a job. That's just not how America is put together, and we all should know better than that. And
I just don't want to
buy into that argument in the first place. And yes, illegal immigration is a problem. Let's deal with it. And it impacts everyone, not just black people. So, you know, I think that we just need to be honest about that. But that's just my
That's true. And I can't let you go and without, we're almost out of time, but I found a little, one of our researchers found a little factoid about you that you took America to school this week because you described President Trump's declaration of a national emergency as feckless, and Webster's online got a 1,600% increase in word searches for feckless. So thank you for improving our national vocabulary.
Every little bit I can do to contribute.
That's something, though. I love that because Merriam-Webster also analyzes the words that are searched and why. And it's fabulous that you were a part of that conversation.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. I got friends calling me and saying, dude, you're trending on Twitter. I'm like, really? Why?
People looking up
what you said.
I just had to laugh when I saw that. Well, thank you so much for your generosity to be on our show. And let me tell you that when you decide to run for Senate or whatever you decide to run for, you've got your first volunteer right here.
I'd
be happy to come out and campaign for you, Lieutenant Governor. I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about the Institute for Politics, Policy, and History, but maybe you can come back sometime.
You got it. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you. And continue the success.
Take care.
With all of your everything that you're involved in. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to leave you with a song tonight and dedicate it to our guest, because I'm an old hippie. Here's one from the Young Bloods called Get Together, about bringing everybody together. And that's really what we want to do. Thank you.
Love is but a song we sing, fears we will die. You can make mountains ring.
In the capital of this nation, 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.